test the alarm. Absolutely. Okay, 97-3620, 3626, 98-0092, Kett, Mader, and Johnson versus Community Credit Plan, and counsel still the same. Mr. Moglowski.
Thank you. This is a consolidated appeal involving three of the parties in the fee-shifting case. It's an appeal from a decision of District 2, Judges Brown, Nettesheim, and Anderson. In that case, the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded a summary judgment by the Circuit Court of Waukesha County, the Honorable Catherine Foster, Judge, and a summary judgment entered by the Leavenworth County Circuit Court Judge James J. Carlson. Judge Foster granted a summary judgment to Community Credit dismissing the wrongful repossession claims brought by these three customers, and also granted summary judgment dismissing their alleged prohibited debt collection practices claims under Chapter 427 of the Wisconsin statutes. That was Kett and Mader. Judge Foster had concluded that Community Credit did not violate either the venue statute or the statute 425-206, which limits non-judicial replevins in secure transactions. In the Johnson case, Judge Carlson granted summary judgment to Community Credit on the issue of the wrongful repossession and dismissed the complaint on that issue, but denied summary judgment on the prohibited debt collection practices, holding that that was a question of fact for the trier of fact. We believe that, looking at the court's opinion, I must say it was a little difficult to read that opinion, but this is what I gleaned from their decision, that as a matter of law, Community Credit violated the Wisconsin Consumer Act venue statute by commencing the replevin actions in Milwaukee County because Community knew or had reason to know that the venue was improper in that county. Two, that the Consumer Act treats venue as a jurisdictional issue in consumer credit transactions. Three, failure to have a proper venue means the replevin judgments are void. And by repossessing collateral pursuant to void judgment, Community engaged in a non-judicial repossession in violation of 425-206. The court concluded that secured creditors repossessing collateral is also engaged just by the act of commencing an action. Litigation is now a debt collection under 427. This is going to be an issue of first impression before this court, and that is an attorney who is not making communications or trying to collect a debt, a personal debt by letters or whatever, but merely by starting a lawsuit, the court seems to have held that that itself is a debt collection practice under Chapter 427. I disagree with that. We're asking this court, of course, to reverse the decisions of the Court of Appeals and reinstate Judge Foster's summary judgment on both the wrongful repossession and on the debt collection practices violations, to reinstate Judge Carlson's summary judgment dismissing the wrongful repossession claims, and reversing Judge Carlson on the issue of debt collection practices, ruling as a matter of law that commencing an action, starting litigation, cannot be deemed a collection under the Wisconsin Consumer Act, Chapter 427. We've talked a lot about the venue statute this morning, and again, the venue statute, as I view it, is a fluid statute, one in which at least due process jurisdiction was acquired when these defendants were in fact served. And I note that some of the cases that were cited by counsel on the issue that judgments are void, those cases were really due process cases where there wasn't any service. Here, there is service. These customers had notice of the hearings, had notice of the return date, knew who the lawyers were, and basically threw the summons in the basket. They ignored the court. Yes?
We're going to determine in that other case whether or not what the significance is of the lack of venue, okay?
Okay.
So do we have to assume for this case that the lack of venue is serious and is a violation to get to the rest of these issues or not?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the fact that I think the Court of Appeals misconstrued several statutes, one of them being 801.50 sub 1 and 801.50 sub 5M on the statute, because in this state, until these appellants brought it up, venue has, under our statutes, the venue statute says that a defect in venue shall not affect the validity of an order or a judgment.
But this statute says it does. This other statute says it does.
Well,
so at least for the moment. For the moment. Let me see if I can't get you to talk about the other issues. Let's assume. Then we can assume it the other way. Let's assume that there was a violation, that venue was improper, and you're now at this next suit, and there was a dismissal. And the issue is whether, and you took back the cars, and you sold them, okay? Now, what does the customer here want from you, and why do you object to it? Assume that the venue is bad, shouldn't have done it, you got dismissed, you violated the venue statutes. Okay, now what? Now, this is not a violation of the venue statute. This is that you took back the cars, and you never had a judgment, right?
That's what they're claiming.
What?
They're claiming that it wasn't a valid enforceable
judgment. Well, you dismissed that judgment.
No. That's, yes, we dismissed it after the fact. It was
okay.
Satisfying.
All right.
It's a quasi-in-rem judgment, which is satisfied when you take possession of the vehicle.
Your position is, under what judgment did you take possession of this vehicle?
The ones that were later vacated.
That's right. Okay. So you took back cars. You did not, after you took them back, turns out you didn't have a valid judgment, right?
No. The judgment was set aside for improper venue, but it doesn't mean it wasn't valid judgment.
All right. The judgment was set aside. Okay.
Yes.
Let's just pretend for the moment. The judgment is set aside. You took the car anyway. Just pretend.
Right.
You're not conceding anything.
Okay.
Not to worry.
Okay.
All right. So you took cars under a judgment you didn't have. All right. Now, they say, because you did that, you violated 427.104.1H, right? And 1J. Is that their position? I'm really trying to understand what their position is, and I want to know what your position is, assuming, not conceding, assuming that you took the cars without a judgment.
Okay. The answer to that question is not that easy, but I'll try.
I know.
I'll try. First off, and the Court of Appeals decision is sort of fudgy on this issue, so I have to answer the question in two parts.
Okay.
If we're talking about the wrongful repossession under 425.206, then what they're asking for is the draconian exemplary damages under 425.305.
Okay.
However,
numbers 425.26, and they want 425.
They want 425.305 damages, which are exemplary damages. And what are exemplary damages in this state? They want all their money back.
Right.
They want the value of the collateral. They want a penalty, then they want actual damages, and they want attorney's fees. In other words, and here's a problem. Let's say they had a loan for $10,000, and then they came in and got a new loan to borrow $500 to buy a car. And the company rewrote the loan, gave them $500. So now they owe them $10,500. They default. The company goes out, repossesses the car illegally because they used the wrong venue. And what does the customer get? They get the $10,500 back. They get a penalty, and they get attorney's fees. That's really what they're asking for.
Okay.
Now, the second part of your question, Your Honor,
and that's
yes,
for wrongful possession under 425.
206.
206.
Right.
Okay.
Now, to answer your second part of your question, when you bring in the question of debt collection practices under 427,
right,
if you look at 427, it's the second section on the remedies. What it says is they get a new trial. If a customer is persuaded to turn over collateral to a creditor because the creditor violated a provision of the Debt Collection Practices Act, they don't get 305 damages. They get a new trial on the determination of whether or not they really had a right to retain possession of the collateral. They do get the $1,000 penalty, plus the question of, but they don't get they don't get 305 damages. So it gets confusing. Yes.
Well, what damages do? Where's the damage section for 427.104?
It's in the second section.
Sub 2?
It's
sub 2. All right.
427.
Oops. I didn't think it was 2. Okay.
What was
7?
All right, thank you.
105. The remnants. Okay, it's right next to it. Sorry. I kept looking in 104.
If you note, Your Honor, that for violation,
right.
Sub 2, if a customer establishes that the customer was induced to surrender collateral by conduct of the merchant which violates this chapter, the customer shall be entitled to a determination of the right to possession of the collateral pursuant to 425.205, which is the Replevin statute, in any action brought under this subchapter, and if the customer prevails on such issue, in addition to any other damages under this subchapter, the customer shall be entitled to recover possession of the collateral, together with actual damages and the loss of use. So it's interesting that under the wrongful repossession claim, the damages are exemplary, but under if the creditor's conduct persuaded the customer to return the vehicle because of a violation, which the Court of Appeals said, of the Debt Collection Practices Act, they don't get 305 damages. They get a new trial. So there's an inconsistency there. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. You can also do it under 427.105.1.
I think that's the general damages that you get. That's right. They get 425.304 damages, which is a maximum of $1,000 plus, I believe, actual expenses and attorney's fees.
Now, just let me just summarize. So what really happened here is there was a mistaken venue. There was your client proceeded on that, and of course they replevin, they repossessed, they sold, and all this was over a course of 7 or 8 months, something like that. Now this case comes back. What are you asking? I mean, it obviously costs have been incurred. Your client did something that was wrong, and that started out in the wrong venue. So what are you asking this court to do? Because if you disagree with the Court of Appeals and you don't want to go through the 427, in other words, the exemplary, what are you saying? You just go back and you have a new trial?
Your Honor,
that wouldn't seem to satisfy anyone.
It doesn't, because the truth of the matter is there is no need for a trial because these defendants are in default. They've never denied they weren't in default. None of this is over a new trial, Judge.
This is all over whether there was a violation of the venue statute, which would give them a... Okay, I'll just...
This is all over recovering exemplary damages.
But look, counsel.
Yes.
You keep saying it's only because of the wrong venue. Because of the wrong venue, I should say because of, these guys defaulted. And they defaulted. And this is all because you got a judgment. A judgment you might not have otherwise gotten. Well, let's not get back to that. Let's just assume that you did this without a valid judgment. Let's just look at the penalties, okay? I don't want to get into the venue issue again.
You're right. Under Nicolau, if you don't have a judgment... Now, keep in mind...
Finish that. Okay. Under Nicolau, if you don't have a judgment...
May I address the issue that I think you're struggling with?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. If you look at 425-206, the word judgment is just one word in that big statute. The real essence of 425-206 is legal process. It says, no creditor shall take collateral except through legal process. Now, is anybody in this courtroom going to say that Community Credit did not engage in legal process? We issued a notice of right to cure default. We issued a proper statutory summons. We issued a complaint. We served the defendants. We did everything we were supposed to do except one thing. They're now saying that we had to ensure proper venue. Now, again,
Counsel,
certainly did legal process.
Counsel,
huh?
Your venue was wrong.
I understand that.
Okay. So your venue was wrong. That was one thing out of five elements. It was not legal process. That default judgment was vacated. Now, unless you can get over that hurdle, for this purpose, you took possession of a car, and it wasn't by full legal process. That judgment was gone.
Okay. Can I address that issue?
Sure.
All right. Basically, what you have to do, Judge, if you're going to take that position, is you have to construe 425-206 to say the word judgment doesn't really mean judgment. What the legislature really meant was valid judgment. And, again, what you have to do is you have to ignore this legislative scheme for penalties. If you look at the Wisconsin Consumer Act, and they have all these subsections, most of those subsections at the bottom has a statement that says a violation of this section is subject to, and then it's one of the penalty sections in 425.
Now, counsel, as you make your argument, you seem to be saying, and I don't mean to ridicule you, though, but that the failure to abide by the venue provision was an itty-bitty little mistake. As I look at this Wisconsin Consumer Act, and I look at the federal act upon which it was patterned, venue is incredibly important because, apparently anyway, a lot of defaults were being taken because of failure to abide by the proper venue filings, that there was a very sharp practice that was extant in the country of filing in a forum that was very inconvenient, if not almost impossible, for consumers to be heard effectively. And so it seems to me that the venue statute, the venue provisions upon which all of this is based, is a very important foundation.
Justice Babbage, I don't argue with you one bit. That's not the argument. Remember, these people could have done something. They ultimately found a Milwaukee lawyer. I don't think it's good for this court to send a message out there that says you can take the summons and throw it in the garbage, and then maybe 10 months later, some enterprising lawyer...
The legislature has done that, haven't they?
No, I don't think they have, because remember, if you read the statute on venue, one of the issues, and we've raised in our brief, is when is the determination of venue to be made? And the statute says, on the return of the summons. That's what the statute says. Now, if we're going to ignore everything the legislature said, then I'm done. I mean, then I'm really done here. Again, what did the legislature say? The legislature said it shall be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. In all my years of practice, lack of jurisdiction meant without prejudice. But if you follow the arguments of the Court of Appeals and what has been made here today, it really is a dismissal with tremendous prejudice because we're dead as a matter of law. It's not a dismissal. The statute says the case will be dismissed without prejudice. I mean, for lack of jurisdiction, which means without prejudice. But under the decision of the Court of Appeals, just the opposite occurred. We've become the insurer of venue, and now we're subject to exemplary damages. That's why, and I think, again...
None of this would have happened if you had filed in Waukesha County.
I understand that, Your Honor, but it might be apparent in this particular case, or it might be apparent to this court that maybe in the Kett case or the Mader case, it would have been easier for her to file in Waukesha County. And I have to agree with you. Her office was only a couple of blocks from the Waukesha County courthouse. But she had never been in that courthouse. She had only been in Milwaukee, and that's where she filed. But I think that I think we have to look at it. What's happening in the state? there are a lot of other creditors there who are using non-lawyers to prosecute actions in the small claims court. And are we going to say all of those people are now going to become insurers of venue, particularly in secure transactions? That's really what's at stake here.
Now, would your argument be different if it was a lawyer? Suppose it could have been counsel. Counsel make mistakes.
No. It wouldn't be any different, Your Honor. In fact, as I said, I think it's ironic that a legislature that has a lot of lawyers and the bench and the bar who are all lawyers, somehow we exonerated ourselves from venue violations by saying that all you do is transfer the case. Transfer it to the right venue. No penalties. I think you pay the cost of a few dollars for the transfer, the clerk's fees, but there's no penalty involved.
But in this case, if it was a lawyer, then the creditor could, of course, bring malpractice against the lawyer.
Correct. And I think the issue here is, should I think you have to look at the statute itself. If we're going to look at the language of the statute.
Which statute? We're talking about an awful lot of statutes.
421, 401, the venue statute. Now, there has been a lot of written about void judgments. The question is, the statute doesn't say the judgment's void. Neither 421, 401, nor 425206 says that this judgment is void and of no effect. If you look at the statute, the legislative history of 421, 401, 801.50 sub 5M, which refers to the Wisconsin Venue Statute and the Consumer Act, the answer is the opposite. And I'd just like to read to you from the Judicial Council Preparatory Note to the 1983 Act, which is now 801.50 5M, which is the Venue Statute. And I quote, requires claims arising out of consumer transactions to be brought in the county where the customer resides, where the collateral is located, or where the customer signed the document creating the obligation. It requires small claims procedures to be used for small claims if the defendant resides and can be personally served in the state. Finally, it clearly provides that a defect in venue does not affect the validity of any order or judgment. End of quote. The Judicial Council's Prefatory Notes, the 1983 Act.
This is in the 800, Chapter 800, not
yes.
This chapter.
Correct, but the 801.50 is part of the venue statute. It's one of the six. It's one of the six special statutes referred to in the statute, but none of those statutes say that 801.50 sub 1 doesn't apply. 801.50 paren 1 says that a venue defect does not affect the validity of an order or a judgment. And 801.50 sub 5M merely says that the venue, where to start your action or where to bring your action in a consumer credit transaction, is those places described in 421.401. Simply incorporates the statute. And we're saying that the best evidence of the legislative intent is in that judicial note. And I'd like to also direct your attention, if I might, to the brief amicus that was filed by the Wisconsin Financial Services Association by Edward J. Heiser, Jr., which goes significantly more in depth as to the legislative history of both 421.401 and 801.50 sub 1. And he deals with that in a more substantive way than I was able to do in the limited pages that I had.
If you look at 799.29, which deals with small claims court, it says on opening default judgments, it says the court may order reopening default judgments for a petition duly made and good cause shown. That's 799.29.1. But 1A. But 1C says the court shall order the reopening of a default judgment in an action where venue was improper. So that's mandatory. So if you've got a venue that's improper in small claims court, and 799 does refer to the 425, et cetera, statutes, the court has to reopen it.
Justice Abramson, we didn't oppose it. We stipulated to it.
I know, but I'm trying to say, for 1 year, if you've got a wrong venue, that default judgment is no good.
I'm not saying it's no good, but of course that raises another question. Is the court suggesting that all secured creditors under consumer credit transactions should wait a whole year before they enforce their judgments to be safe?
Not if their venue is right.
But you don't know that. I'll give you an example. Personal cases I've had. I had a case in Racine County where the process server, unknowns to the customer, to the creditor, he photocopied the authenticated copy of the summons and complaint, and he served the defendants with those photocopies. We found out at the time the customers appeared by counsel to contest the action. The only reason we won that case is because they appeared and tried the case, and the court said that was a waiver. I had a case in general.
It's not a venue defect.
I understand that, but it's a jurisdictional defect. It's a fatal defect, and that's what you're saying here. You're saying that this defect is a fatal defect. It's fatal because we're going to get sunk with exemplary damages.
Well, what's wrong with a rule of law that essentially holds you strictly liable for complying with the venue? I mean, if we say that in this case, I would assume that every lawyer in the future that handles a case under this statute is going to make sure that they got right venue.
Yeah, but you never know.
But you said that in your last argument, and I guess I'm giving you an opportunity to respond a little bit further, you said that it's not as easy as Mr. Harmon seemed to think. He said 99.9999%, there's no problem. You just file it on the other side.
I can assure you
that
is not the case. As I said, our office does a lot of these cases. You never know what happens because you think that you... First off, remember, these are default cases.
How do you not know where the contract was signed?
Because in a lot of these cases, they're indirect financing. They come from a dealer. In other words, the lender is buying commercial paper.
How do you not know where the customer resides?
We don't know where they are. Not much better where they reside. We don't know where the car is. We don't know where they are. In fact, in many cases, we have to take judgments by publication because we can't find them. The process servers can't find them. The mere fact that when they bought the car, their address was on the contract doesn't mean they're living there. I've had all sorts of bizarre things. I mean, you have people that supposedly are living with their parents, and you serve the parent, and it turns out later with an affidavit, I moved out of there 2 days before we got served.
Look,
these are difficult cases.
But you ultimately get the car sometimes. If you don't get the car, it's not a problem.
Hopefully we get the car.
Right. If you don't get the car, it's not a problem. If you do get the car, then you know where it's located.
But that's after the judgment.
I know, but you can run in fast. The justice process has to be...
But that's after the judgment's been entered. You can't take the car before you get the judgment.
But you can find out where it is. Justice process.
Suppose Mr. Harmon prevails in both of these cases. What is it going to cost consumer credit? Ballpark.
Including attorney's fees? Several hundred thousand dollars, maybe more. Remember, if he wins on all these issues, each one of these customers gets back everything that they paid to the creditor, regardless of whether it has any bearing on the collateral itself. It could be a loan. Like I said, it could be a loan of $10,000 in which $500 was used to buy the car that was illegally repossessed. So they get back all their money. They get back the value of the collateral that was repossessed. They get actual damages. They get attorney's fees.
But
creditor gets zilch. And all of that is over what is now being argued that the creditor, even if it's not a lawyer, should be the insurer of that venue.
Plus you would subtract the money that you got from selling the car.
That generally isn't very much.
I just wanted to give you the benefit of everything.
Well,
you ever see the movie Repo Man?
Yes. Thank you. Any other questions?
No, and you will have several moments for rebuttal, Captain.
Thank you.
Mr. Harmon.
Mr. Harmon, you heard my question a moment ago to counsel, and the answer was several hundred thousand dollars. I assume that was in these individual cases. Beg your pardon?
Total.
Not in these three cases, Your Honor.
A whole bunch of cases. All right. Well, I mean, all the cases that we're hearing today, all the parties that we're hearing today. Does that seem like a fair result?
Well, Your Honor, there are a couple of other clients that I do represent that are not anywhere before the court here yet, and many others that I don't represent. But
that's a good question. So there will be many others. So if the court would say go with your position and say that venue is a fatal defect, then of course there could be, I don't know, we've got seven cases here. You say you have other clients. It could be literally hundreds, thousands of people out there, or I don't know, that would say, all right, a venue is wrong, and is that a realistic view of this?
Well, Your Honor,
that are justice
there is a one-year statute of limitations,
yes, okay,
for an action against the creditor. So
we're
beyond that. The community credit discovered its error once the motion started being filed in the fall of 1996. So community credit, I would bet we haven't seen an improper filing of venue since that time.
That's for this case, but there would be, is it fair to, picking up on Justice Prosser's question, is it fair to say there could be hundreds, if not thousands, of other cases out there that if we say venue is fatal, that's it, and it's you don't know or don't see that?
I don't foresee that, Your Honor. I think that most creditors follow the law,
sure.
And many creditors use attorneys to pursue their replevant actions.
Well, then they have malpractice. I indicated.
That there are thousands of cases out there that the venue was wrong. Is it fair to the debtors of this state that the statute not be adhered to?
Your Honor, I think the legislature intended that if this occurred, that their rights to a hearing on the issue of default prior to repossession were so important that the penalty should be severe. Now, in one of the cases, the penalty might be $5,000. Value of a vehicle that wasn't worth a whole lot, and $1,500 that had been paid on the contract beforehand. In another case, it might be $25,000 where someone is paid on a significantly priced minivan. In another case, the Keck case, we're talking about two motor vehicles and a boat and a trailer. The penalties could be severe. The legislature, without the replevin claim in this case, excuse me, the wrongful repossession claim in these cases, none of these cases would exist here today. And the reason is that there is a deficiency claim in each of these cases, which is significantly several thousands of dollars. None of these customers would ever have engaged in a lawsuit against a creditor facing a several thousand dollar deficiency claim. For an insignificant claim of $1,000 or anything of that nature. The claim that is driving these cases is the wrongful repossession claim. It is the only claim in which the original complaints contained. And they added a 427 claim for debt collection practices in response to the position being taken by the creditor in the case that it wasn't my fault, it was the court's fault. And to isolate that conduct out of what occurred before the court, the Chapter 427 claim it was presented. The other most important point to understand here is that the right to a court hearing on the issue of default prior to repossession is the foundation for the customer's rights in Chapter 425. It's the foremost of all the customer's rights in that chapter.
that's big picture stuff, and I'd like to hear a little big picture stuff. What do you think, how do you think the legislature envisioned all of this was supposed to work?
Well, Your Honor, in that chapter, when the legislature first enacted the venue provision, they importantly put it in that chapter, the chapter on the remedies and penalties provision. And there are two methods in which a creditor may obtain possession of its collateral under the chapter. It may demand the return and obtain a surrender, and it may obtain a judgment. In either case, it must jump over certain hurdles to get to that point. The legislature has seen fit to try to balance the interests of the creditor to get what it was supposed to get under the contract and the customer's right not to be unfairly treated in the creditor's efforts to get that by requiring that there be a defined default, not a default as defined by the contract, but as a default as defined by the Act, that the creditor give written notice of that default and a right to cure to the customer, that the creditor wait 15 days before that period of cure has expired, and then, but only then, may the creditor demand the return of its collateral. And the customer, if he surrenders possession of the property, it is a proper, lawful taking by a creditor.
In this case, that happened with one exception, and that's one we've been talking about. It was in the wrong venue, but the notice provisions, the right to cure, all of that was done appropriately in this case?
I know it wasn't in one case, Your Honor.
Okay.
One of the three cases that are before this
jump. Okay.
Pardon, Your Honor?
It wasn't in one case, so that was not done properly.
That's correct, Your Honor. We haven't gotten into all that, those issues. Those issues are irrelevant to the claims that are before the courts. They're irrelevant to a deficiency claim, these rights that the customer is supposed to get to notice and everything. It's irrelevant. We never got them once we're in a deficiency claim. And
Mr. Harmon, why do you claim that these judgments are void rather than voidable judgments? On what basis do you take that position?
Your Honor, under the language of the venue statute...
Well, it says there's no jurisdiction.
There's no jurisdiction.
Why does that lead necessarily to a void rather than a voidable judgment?
Your Honor, it is the only way to protect the consumer. If without a void judgment, you allow the creditor to do what happened here, to violate the venue provision, obviously improper venue, and then proceed to take the customer's property. And there's no way to stop it. The customer has no claim.
Counsel, it's only void for a year.
Pardon, Your Honor?
It's only void for a year. Because under 799, you only have a year to bring it in for lack of venue.
Your Honor, I think that the judgment, it wasn't actually even necessary to remove the Replevin judgments from the record to pursue these claims. That merely was done to ensure there wasn't any further harm from the judgment.
Let's test that. Suppose you had not challenged the default judgment. Now you're here under this second case. You think that's okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Because the judgments were void, Your Honor, and a void judgment may be collaterally attacked.
All right. Suppose you had brought this lawsuit more than a year after that judgment. Would you still say it's void?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's void all the time, even though you can't open it up after a year.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's your position.
Yes, Your Honor. It can be collaterally challenged. It would be the position of the customers in a separate action.
So just let me end. So even after a year, you say you could attack it, or it's still a void judgment? What do you say?
I would say, Your Honor, it's a void judgment from the moment it was entered.
And it can be attacked 2 years later?
Well, Your Honor, the customer only has 1 year to make his claim.
That's where you're...
That's what I wanted to say.
Okay.
What is that? The customer only has 1 year to make his claim?
That's the statute of limitations for a customer's claim under the Consumer Act. Under
4.5, what other attack are you envisioning then? You say, I mean, is that it then? 1 year means that's it, statute of limitations is run? It can't be attacked from any other.
Well, even though it's a void
yes, Your Honor, there would be no basis to it.
Okay, that's what I think you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's what I thought you were saying.
Mr. Harmon, I don't understand what you're saying about the judgment being collaterally attacked. Are you talking about collaterally attacked within 1 year? Is that what you're saying? Or
collaterally attacked in the sense of going to the proper county, filing a lawsuit against the creditor for having wrongfully repossessed property. The statute of limitations to do that, to file that action, is 1 year from when the property was repossessed under the statute of limitations under the Consumer Act. And irrespective of whether the underlying Replevin judgment still was on the books or not, the repossession itself was wrong because the judgment was of no effect and gave the creditor no right to take possession.
So this is a repossession case regardless of the default judgment.
Correct.
You have to go back if you can quickly try and explain to me. I've been looking at, you're under 425.206.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, that's really your major point because that's the one that gives you significant damages.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're not going to get significant damages under any other provision, so lawsuits are not going to be brought because there's no money in it. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
So let's look at 425.206. It says that you have to have legal process in accordance with this subchapter, right? Except when, all right? Now, A says that the customer surrendered the collateral. Your clients did not surrender collateral, right?
None of these three, Your Honor.
Okay. B, the judgment for the merchant has been entered in a proceeding for recovery of collateral, lease goods, under 425.205, or the possession of the collateral, lease goods, under 425.203. Does that apply here? And if not, why not? We have a judgment. It's not the merchant. It's someone who bought the paper, right?
Your Honor, it's the position of the customers that the reference to judgment there must refer to a valid, properly obtained judgment in accordance with the Act's provisions. And if it isn't, it gives the creditor the right to influence the customer's rights. His right to a hearing is denied. The property is taken, and they will never be able to get back that right to a court hearing. Now, Your Honor, the other provision in there is about a surrender of possession of property. Creditor can violate that section if they've given them all the notices, they've made the demand for the return of their collateral, and the customer gives it up. But because the creditor has not informed the customer of his right to a hearing on the issue of default in advance of taking possession, it is a violation of that section. According to the Commissioner of Banking's regulation, that a surrender under that section is not a surrender unless that right, that important right to a court hearing on the issue of default before repossession is explained to that customer before he gives up possession. So it can be violated. And that situation seems even less egregious than the position that these customers were in the middle of the night and the customer's property is gone. It's taken without any forewarning at all.
Your position is it's not under 7, it's not really under 425.205. The judgment isn't it because the second section sentence of subsection 1 is violated. This action wasn't conducted in accordance with 799 because the venue wasn't right.
The replevin actions were?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
They weren't in accordance with 205 because they weren't conducted in accordance with 799 because the venue wasn't right. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Mr. Harmon, could I ask you to comment on Mr. Maglovsky's statement about 801.501, a defect in venue shall not affect the validity of any order or judgment. Why isn't that dispositive?
Your Honor, in 1984, the legislature enacted that specific language of 801.50. And as part of that, that was to follow the Judicial Council's recommendations. Their scheme for improper venue was to merely transfer the action, have the action transferred to a proper venue. Included as part of that Judicial Council's recommendations was a provision for consumer transactions. And for consumer transactions, it prescribed the same remedy, transfer to a proper venue. 11 days later, the legislature saw fit to enact a new law specifically and solely for consumer credit transactions, a narrow area under consumer transactions. And rather than follow the scheme of the Judicial Council's recommendations, they decided not to. And they specifically enacted a provision as part of subchapter 5 to the creditor, to the customer's remedies and penalties chapter, that said that when for consumer credit transactions, when venue was improper, the court shall lack jurisdiction other than to dismiss the action. And that is what the law, as originally enacted by the legislature, specifically stated at that time. In 1987, they rolled that language into the present section without
issue. What were you just quoting from?
From subchapter 5 of chapter 425 statutes 1983-1984, which was... It was part of the remedies and penalties section of that chapter. There is no longer subchapter 5 of that chapter.
Well, and it's become 421.401 sub 2 sub B.
Correct, Your Honor. In 1987, there was existing two venue statutes under the Wisconsin Consumer Act. The one in 421, which governed just consumer transactions, and then the one in the remedies and penalties chapter that governed consumer credit transactions, the type of transactions involved in this case. And then in 1987, they brought them both together, but they retained the substance of them. They merely changed the format and location to one section now for venue for all transactions covered by the consumer.
But how does that answer Justice Cross's question about the relationship between 421.401 and 801.50?
Your Honor, I believe what the legislature intended to do was to make an exception to the general premise set forth in 801.50. And if there's a general law and a special law, specific law on the point, the specific should be enforced if it reasonably can, to the extent it can.
But 5M, which your opposing counsel cited, 801.55N, does refer to... 421.401, and so you can make a good argument, which he made, is that 801.51 says a defect in venue doesn't affect the validity of a judgment. And that's his argument.
And that section, Your Honor, did refer to subsection 5, too, specifically, when it was originally enacted, for section 5M. It referred to both of the two sections under the Consumer Act that govern venue. It said you can go to 421.401, which is for consumer transactions, or you go to subchapter 5, which was actually section 425.501. And that's what 5M originally said. Go to either one of them as it applies. And then you go to 5, and you go to the subchapter 5, and it had that language in there, the specific language. The court shall have no authority other than to dismiss the action.
And was the language of lack of jurisdiction put in 421?
Your Honor, it was originally put in section 425.501, which no longer exists.
Right. Okay.
And that was put in 11 days after the Judicial Council's recommendation was adopted of the scheme to transfer venue to
so
a proper...
it's a subsequent provision, you're trying to say.
Yes, Your Honor. A subsequent act by the legislature, a conscious decision by the legislature to change the scheme that the judicial counsel had come up with a mere transfer to a proper venue. And they did it with language which specifically stated the court shall lack jurisdiction other than to dismiss the action. And that is the language now. It's slightly changed from today. Court shall dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, but it's substantively, it, we believe it is the same. Without a remedy of wrongful repossession, the customer loses any defense that they would have under the if the creditor had followed the law correctly and pursued venue in a proper form. Matters that would have been defense in that earlier action are lost, and they're lost forever. There is no incentive without a wrongful repossession claim for a creditor not to repossess property if it obtains an erroneous judgment. There's nothing to stop the creditor. It can go ahead and execute, grab the property in the middle of the night without penalty. It can get its property sooner. And if it's going to be $1,000 less on the deficiency claim, it'll still be well worth it to take the property in advance, early on, rather than have to go through a further lawsuit, a further replevin action, in a proper venue where they would have to afford the customer his rights to defend, which they might have a valid defense. And that the question of was there a default, were they entitled to possession, these customers refused to concede that issue. That issue has never been judicially determined. It was until those records were removed, and there was some record of a judicial decision of default, but there is no longer any record of that. There's been no judicial decree that any of these customers defaulted or were obtained those rights that they were entitled to, that the creditor properly jumped over each of the hurdles before it took possession. And if there's no wrongful repossession claim, the deficiency claim will go forward. There's been no defense related to the loss of those rights relative to that claim. A motor vehicle, as each is involved in each of these cases, is a significant asset to most people. Many people, it's next to a purchase of a home, it is most significant. To these customers, it probably was the most significant. People that haven't risen to the level of being able to acquire homes. The loss of a motor vehicle can mean the loss of a person's job. Loss of a job can affect a person's entire family. It is before a creditor goes out, sends its agent out in the middle of the night to repossess property, it has the ability to stop, think, look, review, have an attorney review, have some knowledgeable person review the judgment it got. Is there an appearance of proper venue to the action where I got the judgment? If there's an appearance of proper venue, they can proceed. In each of these cases, there was no appearance whatsoever. It was obvious that venue was improper in each of these cases.
Mr. Harmer, could I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry I get so emotional. I don't mean to.
If in the first case, the court were to rule that the customers prevailed and that the act was violated because venue was imperfect or mistaken, but we didn't agree that the judgments were void, what damages do you get besides attorney's fees in the second case?
Your Honor, if the court finds that there's a claim under Chapter 427, the customers would get a maximum of $1,000. If there were no 427 claim, under Chapter 427, the debt collection practices claim, there'd be no penalty. The only penalty would be the customer's penalty for having gotten a lawsuit where they end up with a default judgment, a deficiency judgment against them for between $2,500 or $4,200 or whatever the deficiency amounts being claimed are. and no attorney fees. The only claim that's driving these cases is the wrongful repossession claim. And if the court doesn't find that to be a valid claim, basically these customers have no remedy, no effective remedy. And if a client were to approach an attorney after it had occurred, after their property had been repossessed, the attorney would merely tell them, you can't afford to get in a lawsuit with the credit company. Don't do anything. Maybe go back to the proper county and we'll get the judgments reopened and set aside and off the record book, and at least you won't suffer any future harm. Just any past harm from the existence of those judgments. But nothing more can we do for you, the customer that has lost his right to the hearing in a proper venue on the issue of default. He's lost those rights forever by not having appeared and objected to venue in the first case, which is contrary to what the legislature intended, the result. If he didn't appear, venue was obviously improper. No judgment was to be entered. The case was to be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. So the claim that's driving these cases, it was driving from the outset and still is wrongful repossession claims. There is some suggestion of another form of claim in these cases, an unconscionability claim. Well, if the conduct of the creditor and the action of the creditor in going out and repossessing property is not a violation of the statute that specifically governs and controls that conduct, it should be a nearly impossible argument that it was a violation of some other section, the unconscionability section or otherwise. Certainly can understand why the creditors would like that. It makes it more difficult to prove. The penalty is $100 plus any actual damages that you get. And it makes it more difficult for a customer to prove it and easier for a creditor to defend against that type of a claim. But with a statute that specifically governs that type of conduct, of taking possession of property on the books, check the wrongful repossession statute is the basis for the customer's claims here. And there's no way to afford another hearing to these customers in the future. The procedure under Chapter 425 can't handle it. There would be utter confusion, serving them with another summons. They're going to lose the property he's already lost. Are you going to give them right to redeem in the complaint as you have to under the procedure and tell him that he can get his property back if he pays for all the past due payments during which he didn't even have possession of the property? It doesn't fit under this legislature scheme. They have set up a balance between the creditor's rights to get the property and the customer's rights to hearing beforehand to what's fair, and it upsets the whole balance. You can't go back and change that procedure by giving them a hearing after the fact. It's just utter confusion. The questions presented here concern fairness to customers. There's absolutely no question in any of these cases that this creditor did not comply with the laws intended by the legislature. For whatever reason, it ignored completely the venue provisions of the Act when it proceeded to obtain default judgments against these customers at an improper venue. And again, when it proceeded to send its repossession agent out to take possession of the customer's property. It will be unfair to these customers and all other customers who find themselves similarly situated in the future to not recognize as valid the types of claims alleged here, claims which will afford customers a realistic and effective remedy for clear-cut failures by a creditor to comply with the Act. Without recognition of these type claims, the balance, as weighed, measured, and specified by the legislature, the balance between the rights of creditors to obtain what was agreed and the rights of customers to be fairly treated by creditors seeking what was agreed, will be upset. Thank again to the members of this court for the distinct honor it's been to appear before you this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Harmon. Mr. Mongolowski.
I think first I'd like to address this fairness idea. I don't think the legislature intended that the Consumer Act be fair only to customers. What about the creditor? And I think that if you read the brief submitted by Mr. Heiser, you'll understand the legislative history of 801.50 sub 1 and 421.401. Consumer Act was an attempt to be a balance, to give the customers and the creditors a balance. This idea of a fair hearing sort of upsets me, because they were given this idea. They were given a notice of right to cure default. They didn't cure the default. They were served a summons, and the summons says, if you don't appear, a judgment will be entered against you accordingly. I think what's happening here is there's now this suggestion that somewhere in this legislation, the legislature abandoned what is true in all other venue cases. In all of the venue cases, the defendant has to raise the venue. You have to get a lawyer, and you have to come into court, and you have to say, hey, there's something wrong with venue, and you got to point out to the court what that venue is. Apparently, the spin on this case is that the customer can just ignore a summons. Is that the message this court is going to send to the public? Ignore the summons. Throw it in the basket. Why did they wait 10 months to raise their rights? Their cars were repossessed. They were picked up shortly after these judgments were entered. Why didn't they call Mr. Harmon then? At least we could have corrected it, given them the cars back, done something if we were wrong. But you wait until after the fact, until after the horse is out of the barn, and then come in and say, you are the insurer of venue, and now we want all of our money back, and we want attorney's fees, and we want everything else. Counsel made the comment about there's nothing to stop the creditor from doing these bad things unless this court stops them. I disagree. First off, most creditors try to be in compliance with the law. Secondly, there is remedies available. If the court finds that there was a violation of 421.401, the legislature prescribed the penalty, 425.302. That's the penalty that the legislature prescribed, not the penalty that the court made up out of using a legal fiction. Let's face it. Void ab initio is a legal fiction. No one can say that on the date the judgments, that the cars were repossessed, there was not a judgment of record. Of course there was a judgment of record. But now we want to say, but we're really going to say, we're going to impose a legal fiction and say that judgment really didn't exist. Well, of course it existed. It existed in the circuit court of Milwaukee County.
Counsel, could you respond to this? And this is the argument of your opposing counsel about the legislative history. I note that the Judicial Council note at the bottom of the statutes on 801.